This is the Poetry Magazine podcast for March 2012. I'm Christian Wyman, editor of Poetry Magazine.
And I'm Don Scher, senior editor of the magazine. On the Poetry Magazine podcast, we feature readings, commentary, and an interview.
It's the translation issue, so this month on the podcast, we're going to hear adaptations of Rimbaud, Rilke, and Sepphoris by Geoffrey Brock.
How passionate our life, how full of sex and song, spirit and heart, how wrong.
Poems from the Kabbalah translated by Peter Cole.
May the light of that morning continue to shine when you came into my mind.
And then we're going to speak to Jean Valentine about Marina Tsvetaeva.
Many, many poets love her without being able to read her very well because she is so mysterious.
Also in the March issue, we have translations of the German poet Gottfried Benn by Michael Hoffman, a Borges poem translated by Tony Barnstone, psalms by the German Iranian poet Said, translated by Mark S. Burroughs, and a whole lot more.
We spend a lot of the time reading poems looking out for things that might go well in a translation issue, so we kind of keep our eyes peeled through the year.
And more so this year than in other years. Often we find ourselves scrambling at the last minute, you know, trying to find poems from different languages that will round it out, and we usually only assign one poem per poet. But this year, Don and I were actually on the ball, and we decided to, or maybe not, maybe it's the opposite, but at any rate, we decided to gather them slowly throughout the year and sort of let what came across the transom determine what the issue looked like. The disadvantage is that you don't get a lot of Asian languages coming. We just simply don't get that coming across the transom. We don't get stuff from Africa. It's very difficult to get that. So this issue is much more concentrated than issues in the past.
We still think it makes a kind of interesting anthology to read through. And, of course, all the poems come with small prose commentaries by the translators to talk about their interactions with the work, their experiences of the poems, their interest in the poets. And in a way, those are as much fun or sometimes even more fun than the poems themselves to find out why people are drawn to a certain kind of poetry.
Yeah, I love those prose pieces. Don, is there some translation you particularly like? Do you want to start us out?
Sure. We have a few tiny little poems by Antonio Porcia, translated by Gonzalo Melchor. And what's interesting about these things is that they look like aphorisms on the page, but the poet called them voices, and he wrote these things over a long period of time and just accumulated and accumulated them, and they say things like this. Some things become such a part of us that we forget them. Or, I want because of what I wanted, and what I wanted, I wouldn't want again. And so there are a bunch of these things, and I guess he has a lifetime of these voices that he self-published, which is interesting too. He just gathered these things together over the course of his whole life.
And he published them, and then, you know, when they came out, he had so many copies that he didn't know what to do with, and so he ended up, you know, giving them away to libraries, right? There was an edition of Porcia many years ago that Merwin did, I remember.
Yes.
And I guess Gonzalo Melchor is redoing them all, and maybe he's finished now, I think. But they are these wonderfully eerie, provocative, incisive things that just sort of float on the page and into your consciousness. Don't speak to me. I want to be with you. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it really is. In the little prose piece that goes along with it, we find out that one of the poet's favorite sayings was, know how to wait. So maybe these have found the right time.
Yeah. There was a poem that I liked a lot and was moved by in this issue by a poet from Honduras, Roberto Sosa. And it was translated by Spencer Reese. And the poem goes like this. The poor are many, and so impossible to forget. No doubt, as day breaks, they see the buildings where they wish they could live with their children. They can steady the coffin of a constellation on their shoulders. They can wreck the air like furious birds blocking out the sun. But not knowing these gifts, they enter and exit through mirrors of blood, walking and dying slowly. And so one cannot forget them. Spencer has become a Anglican priest in middle age, and he's now in Spain, but he was in Honduras in 2009. He gives the genesis of this poem. The bishop, he was meeting with his bishop one night, and the bishop pulled this poem out and said that for him it distilled the experience of the poor in Honduras, and Honduras is one of the poorest countries in the world, the poorest Spanish-speaking country in the Western Hemisphere, in fact. And Spencer was very moved by it and memorized it in Spanish and carried it with him and then finally just felt an obligation to bring it over into English. And he says very beautifully that, stripped of its Baroque excess, the poem hangs on the page like a crucifix, which I think is a good way of describing that spare language and the feeling that the poem gets, which is one of sadness and stark, obligation to remember the poor. It's a good poem for our time.
Yeah, it's an emblematic poem, which is, I think, part of what Spencer meant there about the way the poem hangs on the page. It's one of those poems that stays with you, and I can almost see people tearing this page out of the issue and tucking it away, because it really is a poem that will always have the meaning that it comes with. It was first published in 1969, but it seems to me to be a timeless poem.
Jeffrey Brock's poems and translations have been appearing in Poetry for almost a decade now, and in the March issue we have something that's a little bit different from him. They're not translations, but what he calls imitations.
Brock has taken poems by Rimbaud, Rilke, and Sepharis and roped them together in a three-part poem with the Shakespearean-sounding title, Alteration Finds.
All three of these poems are sort of famous and have been translated many times, and so I knew that I couldn't damage them in any way by taking these liberties, so I felt free to sort of piece them together as a kind of a collage or a triptych or something like that.
We'll listen in parts. The first is taken from a few lines of Rimbaud's long prose poem Délire from A Season in Hell, and here's Jeffrey Brock reading Delirium after Rimbaud.
How many hours I kept that vigil by your side, entire nights, eyes wide, as you so sweetly slept. What I was wondering, why you yearned to evade the real. No one has prayed harder for anything. It wasn't for your life I feared, but for mankind. Did you, in the end, find secrets for changing life?
The second part is based on Rilke's famous sonnet, The Archaic Torso of Apollo. Here's Defaced after Rilke.
The head we cannot know, nor its bright fruit the eyes. And yet the body has its gaze, a lamp turned low. Or else the breast would cease to dazzle, the hips fail to curve into that smile that begets more than a kiss. And flesh would lose all life, not flare, till there's no blind it can't see you behind. You must change your life.
The third part is an imitation of another famous poem by George Sepharis.
Denial, after Sepharis. The afternoon grew hotter along our secret shore. We thirsted in the glare, but couldn't drink the water. On golden sand we traced your name beside the sea. The wind came like a sigh. Our writing was erased. How passionate our life, how full of sex and song, spirit and heart. How wrong. And so we changed our life.
It occurs to me, it's actually just occurring to me that at this minute it's funny for me to read these poems. The first time I met Jeff Brock was, I guess, right before the divorce that he describes in his prose note, which sort of is the background to these poems. And I stayed at his house. We went out to dinner that night, and I met his wife, and I got to know him at exactly this time. I never made that connection. And Jeff has developed into, I mean, people know him as, you know, one of the most famous translators in the country now. He's unbelievably skilled and just fantastic.
Yeah.
But he's also, I think, an underrated poet. I think his poems are fantastic.
Yeah.
We publish a lot of them, and they're formal without being buttoned down. They have all kinds of taut pressures and intensities in them like these do.
Mm-hmm. What Jeffrey Brock has done so wittily here is he's not only found a way to contend with them individually, but he's linked them all together so that each of the poems is obviously about changing your life. Of course, that famous Rilke line, "You must change your life," can be so inert to us now because we're inured to it, and now
right.
He's enlivened all of these things together. Sometimes the liberties that a good poet takes with other poems really brings them back to life or restores the life that they had to them for new readers. So just when you think this bit about changing your life sounds a bit pat and rote, you know, here's a triptych of really changing your life. And funny thing about that is I guess for a lot of people, poems will survive other kinds of relationships that we have. That's the case here. These poems have stayed with him beyond the painful demise of the relationship that sort of occasioned his thinking about all this.
They're also emblematic of our age in a way, the way that Eliot said, I have shored these fragments against my ruins. And the wasteland was made up of all these fragments. And here's, these two are fragments, one literally, the Rilke archaic torso and that he's describing there. And Jeff makes something very different out of them. He has made something very contained and whole out of these fragments. But nonetheless, they are sort of pieces from all over the place, his life and also the life of these countries. It's very interesting that the Rimbaud became a protest slogan, and the Sepphoris bit, that poem Denial, it became a famous protest anthem in Greece and was actually at his, at Sepphoris' funeral, thousands and thousands of people followed the coffin and were singing this song, which had been set to music.
Of course, even as we speak, there are protests everywhere. There are occupations and protest movements, particularly in Greece, as we record this. So these have taken on not just a new life for this particular poet or person, but I think he's leveraged them into a real interaction with the world, which in a sense is what these poems were designed to become in the first place. So he may feel that he's done versions or what he calls naughty hybrids, but the fact is that poems are elastic anyway, but these have sort of oddly sprung back into their initial designs because of the liberties that the poet has taken with them.
That's a great way of putting it. Peter Cole is a poet and translator living in Jerusalem, a city he wrote about a few years ago for this magazine. His book, The Poetry of Kabbalah, Mystical Verse from the Jewish Tradition, is coming out in April from Yale University Press.
We have a portfolio of 9 poems from that book. They span hundreds of years and several languages, and they're all rooted in Kabbalah, an elusive term that we asked Peter Cole to define for us.
Kabbalah is the most sublime and the most dangerous form of study in the history of Judaism. In a nutshell, it's the tradition of esoteric, mythic, sometimes magical, and most people would say mystical Judaism.
Historically, Kabbalah emerged in the late 12th and early 13th century in southern France and northern Spain.
But as the Kabbalists themselves saw it, the tradition really extends back to scripture and certainly to the Talmudic period. Just one other point that's interesting to make. The term Kabbalah literally in Hebrew means both tradition and reception. So for a poet, it's a highly charged term.
Poets might also get a charge from the absolute importance that letters, words, and poetry itself had for the Kabbalists.
The stakes in this poetry are extremely and unfashionably high. For example, we find Kabbalists talking about the ways in which a poem can extract light from the container of sound or bring about direct vision of God's glory. It can eradicate the forces of darkness in the world. It can bring about an erotic union on high and affect a sacred marriage of feminine and masculine aspects actually within the deity.
And that's a hell of a long ways away from Auden's famous dictum that poetry makes nothing happen. But Kabbalah, above all, is a spiritual discipline with a complex mythology where God is depicted in ways that would make a contemporary monotheist blush.
Kabbalah takes the simple notion of God who is one and refracts that notion in a kind of return of the repressed mythic dimension of Judaism.
So what can a contemporary reader, unversed in this highly esoteric tradition, get from its poetry?
These poems provide or present us with what I think of as allegories of inwardness or analogs of expressiveness. You know, what do I mean by that? Well, I'll give you an analogy. Rodin, when he was reading The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis, said that he would occasionally substitute for the word God the word sculpture. and interesting things would happen. So too in this poetry, you might substitute the word poetry for God, or for Torah and scripture, substitute the word poem. Angels become words and the letters of the poem. And when you begin to do that, you are actually reading in a way that's analogous to the way the Kabbalists read, and doing so takes you into a world of really marvelously ramifying meaning. And in that world, everything matters, and everything mirrors everything else and is linked to everything else.
Well, let's listen to a few of these poems and see what happens. The unknown author of this poem gives an intimate description of what the spiritual adept sees and hears in heaven.
So what you'll hear is not a poetry of personal voice. It's not a meter-making argument with the self. It's about the relation between God and the angels on high and humankind below, and the link that's established between all of them through hymns and poems.
The poem in translation is called Each Day.
Bechol yom v'yom, bahagia alot ha-shachar, melech hadur yoshev u'mevarech l'chayot. Lechem chayot ani omer, lechem briot ani mashmia. Each day as dawn approaches, the king sits in majesty and blesses the holy creatures. To you, my creatures, I speak. Before you, I declare. Creatures who bear the throne of my glory with all your heart and willingly with your soul, blessed is the hour of your creation. And exalted is the constellation beneath which I gave you form. May the light of that morning continue to shine when you came into my mind. For you are a vessel of my desire, prepared and perfected on that day. Be silent, creatures of my making, so I might hear my children pray.
That's a very beautiful ending. I had it marked in my issue here. I thought the lines were so good. I should say a word about Peter Cole. I had breakfast with him and his wife a couple of weeks ago, and he told me a story about when he was a kid. He was, just got out of college, or if he finished college, I'm not sure he did, but he took off to Greece and he wanted to live near Jack Gilbert. He admired the poetry and the life of Jack Gilbert, and so he goes over there and he shows up at his door and he says, here I am. What do I do? And he said, Jack Gilbert said, you got to have a plan. And Peter said, well, my plan, this is it. This is it, baby. I'm here. This is my plan. Teach me. And he ended up staying there for a while and learning. And I guess Jack Gilbert put him on a course of reading. And all of this is a way of saying that Peter Cole is very much in the tradition of Ezra Pound. He is self-taught. He's a polymath. He's an extraordinary person. Knows different languages, knows all these different cultures, literary cultures. And this for him is not some dull scholarly, some dusty thing that he's wiping off. It is very much at the heart of his creative enterprise, just as it was for Pound and different literatures.
Yeah.
And you can feel it in these lines that are very beautiful at the end of each day. Be silent, creatures of my making, so I might hear my children pray.
This is a particularly eerie poem. Here you have the king sitting in majesty, blessing the holy creatures, talking to them. And there's a distinction between the creatures of his making and the children he wants to hear pray.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of sneaks up on you. When the poem stops and is itself silent, what it has said is, be silent, creatures of my making, so I might hear my children pray. And you wonder what that sounds like. Hmm. What is the sound of these children praying? What does it sound like to this vast, majestic presence?
Yeah, and we pay lip service all the time to the notion of poetry getting beyond language or taking us to this wall right at the edge of expressiveness. But these lines actually do that, and they do it with what they're saying, but also in those sounds, the way he hits that rhyme, pray and day, at the end, where each day becomes its own prayer. You feel this vast tradition coming right down to focus on the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to another one. This one is from late 13th century Spain. It's by the writer Josef Jicatila, who is best known for his mystical prose. This poem appears at the beginning of one of his books, both of which are called The Nut Garden.
And the Hebrew word for garden in this case is ginat. And that word, ginat, is an acronym. The G stands for gematria, which means numerology. The N stands for notarikon, which is acrostics or acronyms. And the T stands for tmura, which means the permutation of letters as in anagrams. So the idea is that one's consciousness, the consciousness of the writer and the reader, is constantly shifted by the language, by the writer, from one plane to another, from what a word seems to mean to something else and something possibly much more potent and resonant. And this esoteric manipulation of letters, according to Jekatila, is like a garden wherein ultimate nourishment can be found.
Here's Peter Cole reading his translation of The Nut Garden.
The nut garden holds things felt and thought, and feeling for thought is always a palace. Sinai with flames of fire about it, burning though never by fire devoured. On all four sides surrounded so, entrance is barred to pretenders forever. For one who learns to be wise, however, its doors are open toward the east. He reaches out and takes a nut, then cracks its shell and eats.
One of the striking things of this poem, a thing I noticed immediately when I read it, was that shift east to eats that we get at the end. For the word, you know, it's as if that whole tradition has been ingested, right? And it's, he talks about it in the note, you know, it's the kind of anagrammatic play that runs throughout these poems. But in fact, and this goes to the heart of what translation really is, in fact, this doesn't exist in the original. This is something he's done, right. Something the English has made possible. I love that.
I guess there's an experimental aspect to this. You know, we read a lot of poems that are trying to be experiments or do things with letters and shapes and words. Yeah. And man, this thing encapsulates everything. I mean, all that stuff that gets packed into a nut in this poem, but just the idea that there's a garden with these nourishing nuts in them, these hard, tiny, encapsulated things that encompass, you know, numbers and acrostics and all kinds of permutations of letters. Everything really is, as you said in that introduction, shifted around from one plane to another. Just when you think, you know, a nut is a nut.
Right, yeah. Marina Sotayeva is considered to be one of the most important 20th century Russian poets, intensely lyrical, but also so difficult that even Russians struggle to understand her.
The poets Ilya Kaminsky and Jean Valentine fell in love with Svetaeva's poetry and spent 2 years reading her together. And they've translated many of her poems for a book coming out this fall called Dark Elderberry Branch from Alice James Books. We have several of these poems in the March issue.
We also have, I should say, we have some prose fragments that appear on facing pages of the poems. And these come from various things that Svetaeva wrote over the years, and they cast different light on the poems. And when Kaminsky's and Valentine's book is published, they're actually going to publish it with these same prose pieces there. So Jean Valentine joins us today to talk about Svetaeva and read a few of their translations. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Chris.
You know, as far as I know, this is, I don't think you've translated a Russian poet before. What drew you to Svetaeva? How'd you come to do this?
Well, it was part accident because, in quote, because I sat down next to Ilya. We wrote notes to each other. We were on a panel. And I said, you know, that I'd be interested in working on Mandelstam. And he said, I give you word by word. And I said, that would be wonderful. And he said, you got yourself a deal. So that's how that all began. I'd never met him before, or he me. Anyhow, then we thought, and we talked with friends, and it seemed that since there was a very good Mandelstam translation by W.S. Merwin, that maybe we would try Svetaeva. It's funny, I think many, many poets love her without being able to read her very well because she is so mysterious.
Svetaeva had a pretty dramatic and tragic life. Can you tell us a little bit about her work and her life?
Yeah, her work was begun almost as soon as her life. She started it age 6 writing, I think. She was very, very precocious. And she published a book when she was 18, and she was immediately taken up by poetic people in Moscow. And then she married and had a child. Her life began to go very, very badly with the Civil War. And she had 2 children by then and put them in orphanage where she thought they'd have food because there was so little food in Moscow. And one of them died there of starvation. The other survived and lived a long life, actually. But her own life went on being very, very difficult in every way. She went over to Europe and joined her husband in Czechoslovakia, and they were there, and then they were in Paris for a while, and then he came back to Russia hoping things would be better and was arrested and shot, and her sister was sent to a camp and her daughter was sent to a camp. When she came back with her son, he was a teenager and she couldn't find work and there was no food and there was a place to live, but not among anyone she knew. And I think she despaired and killed herself at that time.
Hmm. Could you read one of those poems for us?
Yeah. She had a famous to us now anyway, love affair with the beloved Mandelstam. This is one of the poets she wrote to him. She was showing him and giving him, in her words, Moscow. He was from Petersburg. So this is a young woman of, say, 24, something like that. And he was a young man. From my hands, take this city not made by hands, my strange, my beautiful brother. Take it, church by church, all 40 times 40 churches, and flying up the roofs, the small pigeons. And Spassky gates and gates and gates, where the Orthodox take off their hats. And the Chapel of Stars, Refuge Chapel, where the floor is polished by tears. Take the circle of the 5 cathedrals, my coal, my soul, the domes wash us in their dark gold. And on your shoulders, from the red clouds, the Mother of God will drop her own thin coat, and you will rise, happened of wonder powers. Never ashamed you loved me.
It's very beautiful, beautiful, especially that ending.
Can you talk a little bit about how you arrived at that wording together with Ilya and maybe a sense of what it's like in the original, happened of wonder powers?
We should say wonder powers is all one word.
One word, yeah.
Yeah, that was kind of great, and Ilya went with it. He usually gave me sort of straight word-by-word translations, and you will rise, he may have had, but he certainly had happened of wonder powers, just the way it's written there. But I thought, let's go with it. I thought it was beautiful. And he said, okay.
Oh, it makes the poem. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all you, yeah. And she herself, she herself may have had a hand in it too.
Right. Right. You know, I wanted to ask you, she's a very formal poet, right? He talks a little bit about it in his prose piece. He once told me that she, you know, I asked him what she sounded like. He said she sounds like Tiger, Tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night.
Yeah. Combination of that and Hopkins, apparently.
Huh.
I remember him tearing his hair at one point when we were together and saying, I just keep hearing her in my head, and she's like Hopkins. It's as if you were trying to put Hopkins into another language. She's almost all sound, you know.
Huh. Wonder powers. That's very Hopkins-like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is.
Well, can you read one more for us?
Sure. The other one is a bit longer. It's our fragment from the desk. And I chose that because it's later. It's 1933, late July. It's a whole sequence of poems that she addressed to her desk.
What was going on in her life then?
1933, she was in France, and she was poor and shunned, lonely. And you'll hear the anger in this. Fair enough, you people have eaten me. I wrote you down. They'll lay you out on a dinner table, me on this desk. I've been happy with little. There are dishes I've never tried. But you people eat slowly and often. You eat and eat. Everything was decided for us back in the ocean. Our places of action, our places of gratitude. You with belches, I with books. With truffles, you. With pencil, I. You and your olives, me and my rhyme. With pickles, you. I with poems. At your head, funeral candles, like thick-legged asparagus. Your road out of this world, a dessert table's striped cloth. They will smoke Havana cigars on your left side and your right. Your body will be dressed in the best Dutch linen. And not to waste such expensive cloth, they will shake you out, along with the crumbs and bits of food, into the hole, the grave. You, stuffed capon. I, pigeon. Gunpowder, your soul at the autopsy. And I will be laid out bare. Two wings to cover me.
Yeah, I guess you've made a revision there to that last line, right? Because we have with only two wings to cover
I know, me. I just did that about 15 minutes ago sitting here.
Oh, did you? I think it's a good change. That's
it
a good
is,
change.
Yeah. The rhythm of two wings is...
Yeah,
is,
I just thought it sounded better.
You know, I love the hesitation that's built into this poem. You know, I have no idea if it's in the original, but that you with belches, I with books, with truffled you, with pencil I, and it's almost a playful, syntactical thing that's going on there.
Yeah, she has a lot of playfulness. I was trying to think who she's like in that. It's hard to think of a regular lyric poet that gets that much playfulness into it. At least it's hard for me to think of one.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us today, Jean.
Thank you.
You can read Jean Valentine and Ilya Kaminsky's translations of Marina Tsvetaeva and everything else you heard on this program in the March issue of Poetry Magazine and online at poetrymagazine.org.
Let us know what you thought of this program. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org.
The Poetry Magazine podcast is recorded by Ed Herman and produced by Curtis Fox Productions.
The theme music for this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. I'm Don Scherer.
And I'm Christian Wyman. Thanks for listening.